Welcome to SideQuests, your high-octane distraction from those other podcasts. We're a pen-and-paper RPG audio show featuring chatter about rules and how to master them, epic world-building, player investment, and interviews with the people who make the games you love. Listen in while we trade tabletop war stories, make judgment calls on odd situations, and do everything we can to give you more RPG resources than you could dream of. All from a simple side quest. I'm Paladin of Podcasting, Eli.
I'm Paladin Rob.
And I am Paladin Craig.
Still Craig, right?
Always.
Wonderful. So I know that we have a tight time crunch today, and that's cool, which makes this episode even more fun in my mind, because I want to talk about flying by the seat of our pants. It's something that as DMs, we tend to do every now and then if we're tight on time, don't get to plan a whole lot. And a lot of players do it. Like, Craig, you noticed a typo on a prop that I made almost immediately, which is cool. My players.
It's my nature, and I'm sorry. I don't want to diminish the fact that you made 8 cool props for your table.
I mean, I appreciate it. Honestly, it was quick. I threw it together. I don't think my players are really going to notice too much, or if they do, they're not going to say a whole hell of a lot. I might end up remaking them anyway because my engraver was slightly off-centered once I pressed go. It auto-focused into a different spot.
For those at home, what is the prop that you're talking about? What'd you make?
All right. So when you brought up the idea of the death flag in your session zero for your in-person campaign, I really liked it. I presented the same idea of not being able to die to my players.
This is in your new campaign, right? Or is this in the one
my existing campaign.
Uh-huh.
So they have actually, they're 15 hours in game time and they have yet to come across an actual combat. I told everybody I wanted to slow this down quite a bit. So prior to their first combat, I presented the idea to them and unanimously they all voted for it, which is different because Craig, you said unanimously your party voted against it.
Yeah, when I finally presented it to them, I forget if I mentioned it on the podcast last time. Yeah, I spelled out the idea. I said, what do you guys think? And they were like, no, we don't care. It's okay. Death is cool. I was like, oh, all right, sweet. Here we go.
Right.
Now, I got an interesting question.
Yes.
Are either of you going to change your encounter creation, or are you going to change anything about what you've already created now that you are not going to or are using the death flag?
I wasn't going to change anything beforehand.
No, cool. I'm not going to change anything. The idea is once they hit zero, they get knocked out like Saturday morning cartoons. And then I like the idea because I'm trying to push my players into more character-driven stories, so they need to be alive for them to do that. Dying every 3 sessions is usually how it turned out because I don't fudge roles, and I'm generally kind of hardcore. I play a lot of Grimdark, so this is new for me. It's new for them. They all jumped on the bandwagon, and I intentionally made it enticing. I was playing with a few ideas, Craig, that you had mentioned. Sometimes, depending on where you get when you play your death flag, there's usually some sort of bonus for it, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I thought do it 5e style, give them advantage, they can roll whatever die they want twice, take the better of the two. But instead I made it as lucrative as possible, and I'm giving them an extra 1d6 on every effing roll they make in combat.
Cool.
So whether it be damage, attack, saves, skills, doesn't matter, combat's going, you get the extra 1d6. And I had a feeling that that was enticing enough to get my players to jump on it, which means they're alive so they can develop their characters more.
Does that mean that it's no longer possible for them to effectively roll a natural one on anything while that flag is up?
They can still roll a natural one.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll still be like an automatic miss. And how I do natural ones, especially once you have multiple attacks, is if you roll a nat one, at any point, it effectively ends your attack abilities. So if you have 3 attacks and you nat 1 on the first attack, you lose the rest of them. Same thing, if you get second attack, you lose your third, etc.
That's how I always, when I played D&D 3.5 or Pathfinder, that always seemed to be the house rule we would settle on for how we ran ones.
Yeah, it's a lot better than saying, you know, hey, there's a critical fumble of any kind.
Can I digress for a moment? We also, back when we were still playing Pathfinder and we were playing 3.5, we also ran into that problem as well. Where sometimes people had like 4, 5, 6, 8 attacks in their full attack. But from my perspective now, like you just mentioned, if you do critical fumbles, then that is much rougher for the player characters than it is for your NPCs and your monsters. The players are going to be making many, many, many more attack rolls than any given NPC or monster. And so they are more likely to suffer from rolling a natural one. Likewise, they are going to suffer many, many, many more critical hits than any given monster or NPC. So if there's some sort of rider effect, like, oh, when you get crit on, you might like have a hand cut off or something like that. Like, that's way, way worse if you apply it to players.
I'm ahead of you on this one, Craig.
Is the light bulb went off over his head. He looks intense.
I don't know where I put my folder. Anyhow, so my players don't know this because we haven't had combat yet, but I'm interacting with the alternative critical rules from Paizo and their Pathfinder 1E system.
So, oh boy, with the deck of cards. I remember this one.
Instead of whole deck of cards, I'm just going to use die rolls to make things easy. So you hit certain percentage over the mark and your critical attack is also mild, moderate, or severely debilitating, depending on the role.
Those rules. I know what you're talking about. Sorry, I thought you were talking about a much older one that came out very early in Pathfinder's history.
No, the critical deck. I didn't think that was very fun, but
it was overwhelming.
But again, I chose that because not every monster is pervy to criticals. So some are immune to them, and this way I can say even though they're immune to criticals, they're not taking the critical damage, they can still suffer a debilitating effect.
Okay, fair enough. The only point I wanted to make though was that if you're ready to say like, hey, that's why I don't do critical fumbles, because if the players make a ton of attacks, will suffer far more from that. Then that's essentially the same thing as saying like, oh, if you are making multiple attacks and you roll natural one, you don't get to make the rest of them. That's going to be pretty punishing to player characters who can make multiple attacks. They're going to suffer that penalty far more than almost anything else will.
Yeah.
I do think that if a lot of the times that's like that, like when you fumble, if you lose all your attacks, that is also oftentimes combined with like a critical or fumble confirmation rolls as well. Like I've seen some games where like the Witcher game where you only critical or fumble if you like are off, like if you critical if you hit by more than 10, or you fumble if you roll less than 10. In Hackmaster, you only fumble or crit if your total, like if you add your bonus to your one, if your attack is still less than their defense roll, or your crit still has to be a total higher than their defense roll.
So the system that you're running, Rob, which system are you running this in?
First edition Pathfinder.
Okay. Are you using critical confirmations in that system?
So our critical confirmations will just confirm critical hits, and then they will automatically max damage on their dice rolls.
Are you confirming your crits? Is that the base rolls where you, I think you roll to hit again?
Yeah, so you roll to hit again, and you just have to break AC.
But do you confirm fumbles?
Yeah. No, we won't critical fumble confirm. It'll just be nat one essentially ends turn.
This isn't to say that using a rule like that is inherently good or bad, but it is something to be aware of, that it is going to weigh heavily on characters that would want to make many, many attacks. So flurry of blows stuff, or you know, two weapon fighters, or that kind of thing.
But it's the same way we've been playing for, I don't know, 12 years, 13 years.
Fair enough.
So
I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Dungeon Crawl Classics has this built into it. But Rob, do you do like spellcasting crits or fumbles?
No, you cannot critical on a spell in my games. And your nat ones are wasted spells, but very rarely do they ever do something like backfire unless there's a reason to do so.
ECC has that sort of stuff built in. It's part of each individual spell. Rolling super well on your casting check or getting a natural one produces dramatic and highly variable effects.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a recent critical or a spell mishap in one of my games, and it's actually produced an incredibly awesome result. The player got hit while casting a spell, and their fumble or their spell casting failure induced them to be like incredibly drunk. So now for the last few sessions, they've just been their character's been wasted, just wandering around, yelling randomly, and like incoherent mumbling. It's been wonderful.
That's funny.
Are they permanently drunk, or is it just like it's been only a few, you know, hours in game?
Yeah, it hasn't been enough time in game. We've had some pretty slow in-game time over the last mm-hmm. three sessions. So
funny how that stretches out, right?
Yeah. It's funny, they're like, just give me a little bit of time to sober up, and then they're just like, no, push on, forward.
All right, if you want a drunk wizard, fair enough. Yeah.
I love that. Gotta love that. I've had my players in my, I don't want to say my primary campaign anymore. However, in my my current NMR game, because the other one hasn't started yet, they've played for 15 hours and they have not surpassed 2 days in time yet, in game time.
Have you been doing a lot of role playing?
Yeah, actually, a whole lot of role playing, which is fantastic. And you know how they tell a lot of the, I don't want to say like the guru of game masters, but you reinforce positive attributes. So I'm rewarding my characters with XP when they role play very well versus just killing shit, because I don't want to turn them all into murder hobos.
Oh, so. Yeah, I accidentally transformed my entire group into murder hobos. I'll tell you that story when you're done here.
Yeah, I want to hear that now.
You want to hear it right now?
Yeah.
Okay, so fair enough. So in my DCC game, the early on, the party was on an adventure where they had been hired by one sort of hill warlock to go sabotage the workings of another hedge wizard. Now, granted, they were NPCs and they were, you know, more established than a player wizard might be, so they were really invading this guy's lair. It's at the bottom of a massive, massive, like, mine shaft. Like, it took them 3 days to walk down the stairs to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, there were multiple encounters along the way. At the time I was running the adventure, Elzamon and the Blood Drinking Box. Titles are great. They got to the bottom, they messed around and did wizard business, and they got beat to hell. In the process, they were limping on the way out. They finished their stuff. They actually biffed the job they were there for. It was find a box, don't open it, get it back to me safely. And they threw it in a pit of acid. On purpose.
Awesome.
On purpose.
That's the fly by the seat of the pants thing, isn't it?
Yeah, fly by the seat of the pants. Anyway, they're like, okay, everything's ruined. We need to get the hell out of here right now because the thing that was in the box came out. We barely defeated it. It's time to go. Oh, God. Oh, wait. There's a whole bunch of horrible things waiting for us that are living on the stairs on the way up. And they were approached by a spirit who was around the area at the time. I know at least one of them definitely listens to every episode of this, so I'm still trying not to spoil this for him. So, you know, podcast episode, audience of one at the moment. But they were approached by a spirit. Basically, there's a dual god of warfare in my campaign, the Blood Brothers. And they don't really have angels. They have the Raging Host, which is the group of other lesser war gods that they have defeated and said, you work for me now. And so they sort of follow him around as like violence angels, basically. This guy said he was one of them. And he said, look, if you'll be my servants, I will help you escape alive. You don't really have an option here. I kind of got you over a barrel. So, you know, death or working for me. And the party decided, among many options, that they were like, you know what, we're going to go for this. So, Breaker of Shields was this thing's name. It had branded them with a rune on their forehead and said, you are now my servant. I own a piece of your soul, and you will do things in my name now. And as a result, they escaped. And the first mission he had for him was, hey, there is another member of the Raging Host that has since escaped the Raging Host and has gone rogue, and I have beef with this thing. Go and find this spirit and destroy it forever. They went and they dealt with it, and I'll skip over quite a lot of story here, because the point is they finished the job enough that they called up Breaker of Shields again in their way, and Breaker of Shields showed up, and Breaker of Shields was thrilled. The job got done, and he was really excited, and he'd grown quite a lot in power, because whole lot of stuff had died, and when you're a violence angel and you got, you know, adventurers killing stuff left and right, like, you feed a lot on that power. So he was, you know, he showed up kind of coked up. That was basically the mood. And he was eager to distribute boons. So he looks around the room and he flexes his gauntleted hands and says, who among you would bear a boon from the Breaker of Shields? You, what do you want? And it was clear that he was not looking for nothing, thanks. And So the first one said, well, I'm really just in this for the money. That's why I'm here. You know, I got your symbol on me. So Breaker of Shield said, okay, I'll give you the Boon of Blood money. And now every time this player character deals any damage whatsoever, that number of coins appears in his pockets. But if he ever takes any harm, that number of coins vanishes from his personal money.
Like that.
If he doesn't have the cash, he takes double the damage that he can't afford to pay out. So all of a sudden he's walking around dripping with bling to make sure that he doesn't just suddenly crumple like bad origami.
I like that.
If I may ask a clarifying question.
Please interrupt
this. If you have 4 gold in your pocket and you take 5 damage, do you double the 5 damage, or do you double the damage that isn't absorbed by coinage?
You double the damage that isn't absorbed by coinage. Or treasure, if you happen to have like a 400 gold piece armband on or something like that.
Will it absorb magical items that have gold quantities?
Sure. The thing is,
so like, they won't take bonus damage until they're naked?
I mean, it's got to be treasure. You know, it's got to be coinage or treasure. And the thing is, if you have a pristine diamond and it's worth several hundred gold and all of a sudden some chunks are missing out of it, like, that's going to be a bit of a hard sell. It's like, yeah, it's a diamond, but like half of it is eaten away. That's, what the hell? This is cut like crap. Like, what's going on with that? The thing is, like, the 2-digit numbers that are going to get swung around for damage, it's not going to unbalance the game. They're not going to suddenly, like, have so much gold that it breaks the game. DCC can't really be broken by suddenly having a massive amount of treasure or not enough. And so it was fun to pass out because it seemed like it would touch on the character's interests. And then it kind of got away because there were 2 more boons. One of them was one, well, the wizard was like, well, look, I don't want to have a giant rune on my head anymore, but I still want to represent you, obviously. I can't get out of that. So what do you do? And he's like, great, you can have the boon of a boon of battle. Now, all of the wizard's spells do fire damage. Like extra fire damage. Uh-huh. Even if they weren't spells that did damage before.
Oh.
Yeah. So this character just picked up Locate Object, which is going to be an interesting... not a lot, just enough to, you know, start fires, that kind of thing.
And that's the easy way to locate an object. Oh, just fall briefly, fire.
Briefly, yeah. Smoke the last signals. One... and this, sorry, what was that, Rob?
Smoke signals.
Yeah, who knows? Oh, yeah, it's got spider climb and a magic missile? Easy. Spider climb? Locate object? Not sure. Detect magic? Well, okay. Well, we're going to see how this plays out. The last one might have been the most extreme, and that's actually one I'd love to hear your thoughts on. So the last one was the warrior. The warrior who I've mentioned before, Edvar.
Oh, we love Edvar.
He'll be thrilled to hear that. Edvar sort of didn't really want a boon from this because he's not super thrilled about working for this Breaker of Shields character. And he said, well, you know, I'm getting, he's just like 70 years old. He's a 70-year-old farmer. You know, he's still swinging a weapon, but, you know, he doesn't want to do this forever. He said, you know, my arm kind of hurts from swinging this flail all day. Maybe if I had like a bigger hammer or something. And Breaker of Shields, again, blitzed out of his mind on newly acquired power, looks at him and says, oh no, you'll fight for me till the stars gutter. Grabs him by the face and burns a rune into his forehead. And when he pulls his hand away, the 70-year-old man is 20 years younger. And he says, you have the boon of ages. You will age a year every day. But every time you kill something, and then I leaned sort of out of character and said, you'll regress in age a number of years equal to the hit dice of the thing you just killed.
Hmm.
Oh, that is gonna be wild.
They were it took 10 minutes before they started debating whether or not, you know, not that they would, but if they were, how would they start purchasing people to stab almost to death and then feed to the warrior?
So we
went straight to war crimes just immediately.
Is Edvar a human?
Everyone in this particular campaign is a human.
Okay.
So that's kind of a tight band.
How old are they now?
Well, Edvar's 50. They didn't all get every boon. I don't think it's ever been specified, but only Edvar in this particular case is specified. Yeah, he's about 70 years old. Now he's 50.
Well, that's going to be interesting. It'll definitely make any time jumps difficult to handle.
We're not really doing time jumps, but they were like, okay. Good. Well, the immediate concern was like, okay. And then Breaker of Shield said, the next thing I need you to do is go pursue this. We're going to play the Jewels of the Karn effects is the next adventure. And the Breaker of Shields named that and said, okay, go to the city and pursue this mystic element of another godling that I wish to absorb. Find them and bring them to me. And they were like, okay, buddy, because what are they going to do? Argue with him at the point? I mean, they could have. That would have been fun. But they didn't. And then it was like, okay, but that's a month of travel on foot away. And Breaker of Shield said, good luck, bye. And he just left. So they're trying to figure out, like, how do we get him there without him turning into, you know, dust?
I think this was a great boon. Because all three of them are actually great boons.
I want to hear your takes. Like, I know it was a little long-winded, but like, did I go too far? What do you think? Would you have done this in your games? Like, do you think it was too much? What's up?
I think they're great. I think they add, like, because like none of them are going to kill the players. They all have added benefits, and they all have something that makes everything just a little bit more complicated.
Complicated is what I was going for. I was hoping that it would provoke more complicated decisions.
Yeah, not complicated. Like, sometimes adding more complication can be a real bad thing. But in this case, it all seems interesting. Are there aging effects in DCC? Like,
no one's ever survived long enough for that to ever matter. But that's not what the Rob's laughing. It's not what the game's generally about, you know, lasting long into your twilight years. No, you've been eaten by a lizard man. Like, that's, but that's that kind of stuff abounds. You know, there's rules for that in Pathfinder. There's rules for that in the old, you know, the old DMG. You know, there's mm-hmm. that's everywhere. So if we get to the point where it's like, hey, dude, you're 90. Like, we got to roll some stuff. I didn't. He wasn't really harassed by old age, given that he was 70. So I wasn't about to like suddenly dump a bunch of them on there. But if he starts getting up into like 80, 90, we're probably going to be like, all right, that hammer's getting a bit heavy.
Because then the other thing will also apply. Like, does Edvar want to get to a certain age to boost some of their more youthful stats?
I think there's a lot that I think there's quite a lot that can be played with here.
I think that's the tricky one. That's the trickiest one, especially at least from your side.
I think in this case with this particular boon, I love it. I think it's great. I do agree that you magically ended up turning your party into murder hobos.
They were like, if we like stab a toad, do we get money from the toad? Should we start collecting farm animals? It's like, oh my God, guys.
Technically, based on how that was worded, that would work.
I did clarify that the life thing and the money thing have to come from basically sapient creatures. They have to do them too. Things that could Fair. Be considered people. And Fair. The bar for people, by the way, is could it theoretically wear pants and can they theoretically pay taxes? If the answer is yes to both, they're a capital P person.
I can justify that for a goat. So, Craig's like, how? I'm like, oh, it's...
No, yeah, just turning the gears here.
Yeah,
so
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. You go, Rob.
Okay. I love the age thing. And I think to make it a little bit more complex, I would nearly consider making him deathless. Not by the sense where he continues to be able to function, where he just continues to age and it's harder for him to do anything to the point of just kind of vegetable, can't move, but he's still mentally there.
Oh, he goes full Crypt Keeper, so he's like the body ages but the mind does not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Just so that way he can always, like, you know, get his body back, but if he pushes it too far, now he's got to make checks in order to just do physical things. That seems like the kind of thing a devil demon would wiggle into some kind of pact, you know, like this is going to get really bad and you don't know about it till you get there.
Because then it's a little bit almost like a torture as well.
What I'm kind of hoping to do here is that, you know, this thing is a hopped up extraplanar creature of battle, of slaughter. Mm-hmm. You know, and it wants to encourage its servants, and it thinks of them as disposable servants, to spread the bad word and yep. do a whole bunch of really nefarious stuff in its name and to reap the benefit of that.
I think
doesn't
you
really
set
want
them
to torture
for that.
but I hope, but the thing is, like, I'm hoping that I've either set it up where they're like, this force is compelling us to do this nasty stuff that we would not normally be inclined to do. And so we either need to find a way to become okay with that and character growth happens, or we need to go out on our own and figure out a way to break this link we have to this thing so that we're not beholden to it anymore. Cause it's pretty clear if they're like, you know, screw you, go to hell, we're not doing this. It's like, I guess you can make that choice, but I still own a chunk of you. So, you know, you're serving me one way or another, either in this life or the next. So,
are they currently like on the high of these boons, or are they trying to find some way out of it at this point?
So Edvar is, I think its player actually is kind of pissed about it, or at least not thrilled about it. Not in like a nasty way, but just in like a, wow, that's rough. That's going to be hard to find my way through. And I respect that. We talked a little bit about it, but I think he's game. The blood money one, that would be Yardak. Yardak, I actually have halflings in my world, but the DCC class is halfling, so he's just an unusually, he's Danny DeVito is really what we're going for here from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Awesome.
Except he got shape changed a little bit from a wild surge in the last game. So now he's 5'8", but he still has the same weight as a halfling when he was like 3 feet tall. So he's just, yeah, anyway.
Now he's like normal size, right? Aren't halflings a little bit the chubbier size?
Yeah, but he got all stretched out. He was like 3.5 feet tall, and now he's 5'8", but he kept the same weight overall. So we got like a like Slenderman thing.
Like that kid from Willy Wonka, Mike TV.
Yeah, there you go. Yardak's thrilled. He's like, great, I can get rich stabbing. It's fantastic. He's walking around with a solid gold chain that he looted in the last thing, just draped around his neck like stabby Mr. T. Yardak's thrilled. And we're gonna find out how the mage, Lavinia, the mage, is really gonna play this one out.
Did you intend to go like evil campaign?
Not at all. And in fact, I don't even consider that this is particularly meant as an evil campaign. I don't think they're actually gonna go out and like, you know, start purchasing chattel slaves to stab up and then put on the chopping block. I don't think they're gonna go that far. The players, bless their hearts, I just don't think they have it in them. Maybe Lavinia's player.
I would bet money I would bet money that they're gonna have fun with this for a little bit, and then they're like, all right, we should probably try to get out of it now.
We're gonna see. They're actually the next adventure takes them into a city, where previously the other ones have been in a mostly the wilderness or the distant outskirts of civilization. So they're gonna have a lot more other forces to contend with. You know, other things like there's a guard now. They have to worry about like, hey, are you the murderers we're looking for? I don't know. Come here and find out. You know, that kind of stuff.
Is that is the symbol? I'm sorry, Eli. I was wondering if the symbol is just easily recognized.
So it's funny. The place that they're particularly going to has a strong concentration of a lot of different worshippers of different faiths, a lot of different, you know, lesser gods. So most places, Breaker of Shields sigil is not a particularly recognizable thing. Maybe some, you know, esoteric demonologist or other sort of thing might recognize it. But at this point, they look like there's something that, oh yeah, I forgot to say. So the not halfling, Yardak, when he got this boon, he got full on, you know, face palmed by the Breaker of Shields. And so that rune now extends basically from the top of his eyebrows back to about midway back down his skull, and it burned off all the hair, and it's still sort of lightly glowing like banked coals, and his eyes turned molten metal gold. So, you know, they're full on going to like the you ever play Fable, the evil path, like you start like shifting around to look like.
Yeah,
they don't necessarily match that. But, you know, you start putting stuff on them and seeing like, now what happens next? Now, what are you going to do about it? I don't think they're going to commit to the fully evil lifestyle, though. I don't think that's their jam. I think they're going to be like, all right, we're starting to get recognized. This is weird. I'm excited. I'm really excited to find out what happens.
Me too.
I'm super excited that your players all have maybe slightly different opinions on how they feel about these boons.
Oh, sure.
I don't know if you had it previously in this group, but I really appreciate when there's internal conflict between a party. And I actually, that's my biggest argument for having like no alignment restrictions, is so that you can have party conflict in like, and I do think that, I mean, all parties should, like, you want to stay together and play together, so they should have some reason to stick together. But having conflicting opinions and like butting heads against the other characters, I think is great ways to help facilitate role playing.
I think this is going to generate a lot more of those kinds of conversations. One of the other party members is a priestess of Meris, of the goddess Slaughter, who theoretically, Breaker of Shields, a member of the Raging Host, is a subordinate too. But this patron spirit that they have is starting to make a lot of claims that sure sound like the domain of that cleric's god, just straight up usurping the position. And I'm hoping that I pointed this out and explicitly said, like, this does not hold water. Like, this is not okay. You recognize this immediately. I am super curious what that player, Shishi is the name of the character. What Shishi, cleric of or priestess of Meris, god of slaughter, is going to have to say about this whole business, because they said they already received a boon, which is how they got inducted. Excuse me, I almost said indicted, inducted into Meris's service. So I don't know if let me tell you about my campaign is equivalent of let me tell you about my character, but there's a lot going on.
I dig it. Eli, have you done stuff like that in many of your campaigns?
I got something a little bit similar in my current game. There's a god that the Seller of Souls is a god who, for all their clerics, like over time, their clerics gather souls, and when they die, depending on how many souls they have, they're like reborn as some form of undead. So like you get like five souls, maybe you come back as a zombie. You know, if you get 10,000, you come back as a lich. So one of my players had a protege. They rolled insanely well. I've never seen someone roll such great stats for a character. Two 18s and a 17.
Damn.
Nice.
It was marvelous. It was crazy.
It's gotta happen
And
eventually, I guess.
then the character died.
Oh
Like in real life, this person was just absolutely heartbroken and devastated that their character died. And so they were like, what can I do to try to bring this character back? And there's not really a lot of ways to bring a character back in Hackmaster. And so I kind of told them, like, if you want to do it, you're going to have to like kind of like jump through some hoops. It's really going to have to be a goal of yours. And I told them about this Seller of Souls. I was like, if you want to do it like the most brute force way, you need 10,000 souls. And so they started keeping like a kill count
Is
and
that
like a soul
10,000
count.
individual people? Is that like 10,000 hit dice worth of creatures, or is that straight up like 10,000 individual kills by hand?
So I'm interpreting it more as the weight of souls, so maybe more of like a hit die representation. So, you know, killing a dragon is worth a little bit more than killing just a rat. It's interesting. It's definitely it's added. Like previously, that character didn't have a lot of like really driving role play goals, and I mean, aside from their lusty quirk, which was no end of interesting role playing, but this kind of gave this made them a more three dimensional character for sure. And so there's been a lot more role playing around this just because of their goal to now kill 10, collect 10,000 souls.
Are they taking it seriously in terms of a narrative thing, or are they like, well, let me go find a couple of anthills in a pot of boiling water?
It's like a like we they came up to a witch's hut and they
Yeah.
found all these frogs and they're like, these frogs seem a little bit too smart. And so Gluck, the character, starts just like he's like, I'm just gonna hunt frogs.
Oh my God.
There they have souls. So they're taking it pretty seriously, I'd say. But not
Nice.
like going out of their way to commit mass murder. They're because they're still trying to like stay within, like they're not trying to ostracize themselves from the party. And there's been a little bit, I mean, the party as a general has a little bit shifted more towards the evil side of things with this. But it's definitely sparked some interesting conversations.
About you, Rob? Anything like this kind of stuff come up with you?
Sometimes I've generally had my players, when they have an opportunity to ask for a boon or a wish of some kind, I'd like to say it plays out interesting, but they're generally super well detailed and they're used to a lot of trickery and backhanded gifts. So I've defaulted away from that and I will just bust out the deck of many things at this point. And it's generally by some traveling gypsy werewolf.
Just get it all in there, all in one.
So I know that most of my players will be like, yeah, I'll at least take one card, and they know the risk of instant death is pretty rare, or instant lose my character is pretty rare. But I'll let them take up to three cards, and sometimes they get what they want, sometimes they get a great boon, sometimes their soul's trapped in a gem forever lost. But went that route because I got tired of trying to work around our rules lawyers and super analytical thinkers, worded wishes and requests.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually given my players any sort of wishing items. So I've kind of managed to avoid some of that, those pitfalls, but it's something that I think would be really fun to do, and it's exciting.
I think for my
That's it.
players, for most of my players, I think the most fun that I could, like, I love the idea of just giving a wish. It'd be like, yeah, it's not a gotcha wish, like you're gonna get what you wish for. It's a boon. You earned it. But if it's like one of the ones where it's like, yo, this is super dubious, I think I could have a lot of fun if I turn to them. It's like, it's from a Rakshasa or something who's like down to play a little bit or something to that effect. But they say like, I'll give you a wish. I'm going to interpret it in the way that's the most fun for me. But take as much time as you want wording it so they know what the challenge is, and then they can take the time to play with it. I think that would be the most fun version of that.
I think now, right now, for my current campaign, if I was to go that route, it would allow me to say, cool, we can pin the rest of this, and then I will give you back next game, kind of how the wish will be granted. Because that's what they're going to be expecting this time around anyway, because we're going slower routes. Gives everybody a little more leeway. I think I can have more fun with it now. I'm more than willing to try, but they're at level 3, so not ready for that yet.
This puts me in mind of something that's coming out soon, for Mothership, actually. So this fairly rules light sci-fi horror game. It's oh crap, I'm blanking out. Is it orbital? It's not. Or is it orbital debris? That's one of the ones. Give me a second. I'm gonna look this up. Hull Breach. I think it's Hull Breach. Hull Breach. So this is on Kickstarter. Hull Breach Volume 1 is an anthology of Mothership adventures. And they've gotten to the point where they decided to link them all into a campaign. I'm super excited for it. I can't wait to run it once I get my hands, excuse me, get my hands on it. But one of the things that's coming with it is a stack of corporate contracts. Each one of them was drafted by an actual lawyer who specializes in contracts, and they are essentially puzzles for your group to get looped into and then read the contract and say, how the hell do we get out of this?
I
Where are
like
the
that.
loopholes? I'm
Can you get this?
super, like, it comes on legal paper, like you can print them out and you can like, or tear them off and like have them sign it, but like, it's just like, yeah, you could do a salvage job and it's split between the surviving members of the salvage team. And like, I haven't seen any of the actual contracts yet, but I am incredibly excited for what that's going to look like.
You dig
You
up a
might have
link for
just
us?
convinced me to back that Kickstarter just with that.
It's long since back, but I'm sure you can find a way to get a copy of this. Like, it's not out yet, but like, I'm super, super stoked for this.
But you're saying you have access to the backer kit.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Again, Craig, can you make sure we have a link for that so we can get that up? That way at least our listeners can see the Kickstarter.
Of
Um,
course, of course, of
so
course.
I think
I
that'd
mean,
be really fun.
speaking of Kickstarters, I recently backed the just within the last few days it ended, but the Cowboy Bebop Kickstarter.
What is that?
What is Cowboy Bebop or what is their game?
Wait, what is it? Is it a Cowboy Bebop RPG?
Yeah.
Oh, the anime. Okay, cool. I didn't know if it was like some sort of like pun on like the name of it. But okay, they're doing an official RPG. What system?
It's their own system, and that's actually why I was like, I think they released a play test, like a very rough play test a while ago with some of the like the design of the characters, and I thought it was very interesting. And I thought it had like a very like the way each session or each adventure is supposed to go. They had like a very interesting way of lining it out, where like as the adventure goes, I think it's like success, like tasks get easier as the adventure gets like more intense. I'd have to reread. It's been a while since I've looked at it, but it had a very interesting like character, like way the characters were created, and it had a very interesting way of lining out how to play it, and I thought that was very interesting.
Like a very procedure heavy thing, something to directly mimic the like narrative beats of the show.
Not necessarily procedure heavy, but more they had like lots of guidance on how to make the game feel
Like an
like the
episode of Cowboy
show.
Bebop.
And
Give
I
us the link.
think,
We'll check that out. That we'll put that in the thing underneath the podcast as well.
and I mean, I am a big sucker for thematically designed game systems. I absolutely hate when people just hack games into other systems where they're just like, oh, we're playing Star Wars, but it's using D&D 5th edition rules. Or, oh, this is, yeah, this, I very much dislike that stuff, especially now when there are so many games out there that handle everything so differently. Like even in the Star Wars RPG realm, there's like the D6 game, there's the D20 Star Wars, there's Fantasy Flight Games, now Edge Games, Star Wars system. And I'm a big fan, although I like the D6 ones and I always play it at cons. I'm a huge fan of the Fantasy Flights game system just because it, the way they've created it, it feels like Star Wars to me.
Mechanics absolutely contribute to the feel of the system. It is also my firm belief that it is not enough simply to take one system and use it for a different theme. All these things matter quite a lot.
I've been running into that problem a little bit because I've been trying to build a few, like I'm a huge DBZ nerd.
Sure.
I grew up with it and it's a guilty pleasure at this point, even in my late 30s. But I've tried to build it on a few different systems and it doesn't seem like anything captures that same essence. So when you, I completely agree when you're looking at this, trying to shoehorn a specific theme into a pre-existing game that's kind of built around a theme on its own. It gets difficult, but to say that I haven't had a good time with some of it, some people get it right, but it seems to be more of an individual person than a published kind of thing.
DBZ, for what it's worth, is super hard to do a game for, I think. I think there's at least one, possibly two official attempts at a DBZ RPG, and as far as I remember, this is very faint, they all stink.
Yes,
I think,
they do.
have you found the official ones and tried them out?
I have, and I don't like them because they still don't, they are missing something. And I've been trying to correct it, but I've been so busy working on a million other things that the template is done, but the content is lacking. So maybe one day I'll finish it, release it for free. Greg, we know that you've got some things going on tonight, so why don't we wrap up pretty quick? So we don't hold you up. We don't hold our listeners up. Anybody want to say something beforehand?
I hope your holidays are tolerable at worst and delightful at best.
If you're
That's
looking
true.
for a holiday present, gift your game master a new system. Just something wacky, something new.
I strongly recommend Ninja Taco Panda.
Oh, that's a good
Taco
one.
Panda.
Yeah, I've played that.
Yeah, it's good. All right, guys, check us out on Facebook, Epic Table Games, and check out the website, epictablegames.com. I'm going to hopefully be getting a blog post up soon. So read that and send in voice messages. Later.
Adios.
I love you. I mean, bye.